Sean, how are you on this fine Thursday as we record this episode of the NHL At The Rink podcast? Are you good?
I'm great. Dude, it's 60 degrees out here on the East Coast. It's fantastic. We're both wearing red. We're in a good mood. We're ready to talk hockey. Despite the red, everything's go.
Are you as good as the Edmonton Oilers must feel right now? 2-0 under Chris Knobloch. Changed the coach. Two wins in a row. They did get the win under Jay Woodcroft against Seattle at the end of that trip before he was fired. Are they cured, Sean?
There's no way you can say they're cured after two games, but I will tell you this. That first game under Chris Knobloch was a good showing, and the after party, so to speak, was fantastic for them to hook him up with his wife by video conference and have her share that moment, because he had come from Hartford the day before. Now, you want to talk about crazy travel. I'd like to see the itinerary from Hartford to Edmonton. But look, there's still issues. I think it helps. I think a fresh voice probably helps. You know, Connor McDavid said that the room hadn't tuned out Woodcroft, but a new voice probably helps. I mean, it's management saying that we believe in you and we're going to change something to try and make this right.
We've seen this 1,000 times, all right? We see it all the time. Before, though, we get into that Kevin Woodley, who covers the Vancouver Canucks for us, and the Canucks, by the way, 3-0 against the Edmonton Oilers, coached by Jay Woodcroft. Kevin Woodley's going to be joining us in a little while to talk about the team in Western Canada who's playing really well. And we're not talking about the Edmonton Oilers there. We're talking about the Vancouver Canucks. But back to the Oilers. We've seen it happen. This happens all the time. A coach gets fired. The new coach comes in. There's positivity. They get the bump. They get off to a good start. Evander Kane gets the natural hat trick. They come back and they win the game against Seattle. They beat the Islanders, but it's a lot of third period comebacks, right? I mean, this is two third period comebacks in a row where they've played well in the third period, and that counts, but this is not a cured team, and I want to see, and we will talk about it eventually, how do they handle this road trip coming up? They play four in a row on the East Coast. They play Tampa Bay. A reeling Tampa Bay team right now that we'll talk about in a little while. They play the Florida Panthers, who are red hot right now. The Carolina Hurricanes, who are trying to establish some consistency, and we'll get into them in a little bit. And the Washington Capitals, who are playing really well right now and suffocating defensively. Let's see where the Oilers are after that. Then we'll have a better idea of what this team is under Chris Knobloch. Two wins in a row. They get the bump. That's all well and good. Three wins in a row if you count the last game under Woodcroft. A little bit of a market correction for a team that's better than it was playing and is now getting some points, but I want to see where they are after this road trip. If they go 3-1 on this road trip, well, hello, Edmonton. I'm starting to believe again. If it's a 1-3 or a 1-2-1 road trip and they don't look that good and they give up some goals and it doesn't really connect, then are they any better than they were? Right? I mean, I understand why they made the coaching change. Jay Woodcroft took the hit for the players. That's the way it was. You can't, they sent Jack Campbell out. They did a few other things. Nothing was working. Coach was the next to go. He and Dave Manson went. They kind of understood it, I think, too. Did you see them walking off the ice after the game in Seattle where they were both like, well, that's probably it, right? And it's understandable. We see this all the time. And now they get the bump. But is the bump going to last when they go on this four-game road trip? That's the big test.
Well, I mean, you talk about the third period comebacks like it's a bad thing.
No, it's good.
Like this isn't a team that could come back in the third period. They were lost. They would get behind and they wouldn't be able to generate anything, and they would kind of look back at their goalie and be like, "Oh man, where are we? Like, we played really well and we're down and whatever." Now they're coming back. Like, that's that mental wake-up, right? That's that you look around the room and you're like, somebody threw a hand grenade. Like, we better wake up. And I think that is the biggest revelation of that whole thing, right, is the fact that now they're in these third-period games where in the past they'd be like, we don't have a chance. And they're winning.
Yeah, they are. And you know what I also liked about this whole thing? Yes, there's history between Chris Knobloch and Connor McDavid. But they didn't just go out and hire a guy who was out of work and coached last year in the NHL and needed, you know, was looking around for a job, a guy who had been around. They went and hired a guy who's had some success in Hartford. He's been around. He's been an assistant. He coached a few games at the NHL level for David Quinn and for Gerard Gallant when they were out with different situations. Quinn with COVID, six games a couple of years ago with the Rangers. But he's a guy who's kind of paying his dues along the way, junior hockey to the AHL to an NHL, I'm sorry, junior hockey to an NHL assistant to the AHL head coach. This, they're hoping here that there's some staying power, right? And they did kind of the same thing with Woodcroft, and there was a little bit of staying power, and the guy did a good job. I mean, he did a good job with this team. They went to the playoffs both years he was there. They won a bunch of, they won three playoff rounds. They were a well above 500 team. They were, why did they go 18-2-1 in the last 21 games last season? They were riding high, right? It wasn't working, but I like the fact that they went to a guy who was new, if you will, was paying his dues and getting an opportunity instead of going back to the well, which isn't a bad thing, but this is a little bit of a new voice, a fresh perspective, and one that these guys have never played against him, most of them. Some of them played for him, right? But most of them have never played against him, so he was brand new, and that brings a whole new level of piqued interest to see what's going to happen here. So we'll see how it plays out. But again, Sean, I stress, I mean, third period comebacks are nice. They get a couple of wins. That's great. Confidence is important. How are you going to do on this road trip?
Well, I think this is an all-in move, right? This is Ken Holland's last move. They can't add. They got no room under the cap. So this was a last move, and I think it's interesting, right? Because it's not a low-risk move. It's a high-risk move, right? I think everybody in Edmonton would have been happy with somebody they knew as the coach. Oh, you brought in John Hines? Okay. I know that guy. He's a good coach. He was good in New Jersey. He was good in Nashville, whatever. Like, there's nothing here. There's no track record, right? And they've seen this. They got the T-shirt already, right? They went through it with Woodcroft, right? And he won 2/3 of his games. I think it's a lot to ask for that to happen twice in a row. I mean, how often have we seen young guys come in and in their first run have a really good run? Most of the time they come in, they have a mediocre run, they leave, and then somebody takes a chance on them a second time, and they're much better. Dave Hakstol, who used to coach Chris Knobloch, who used to be was the head coach in Philadelphia when Chris was there as an assistant, is a perfect example. Guy who came out of college, everybody thought he was the hotshot wonder kid, in over his head, but learned a ton of lessons. Then somebody else took a chance on him, and now you have what you have in Seattle. Playoffs in the second year. They're struggling a little bit right now, but I think there's no arguing that Dave Haxtell's a better coach now than he was in his first go-round.
Oh, 100%. No question about it. I also want to defend Connor McDavid here a little bit too, because I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, well, they hired Connor's junior coach. Right? I mean, they did. That is a fact. They hired Connor's junior coach. He coached him at Erie. But I don't know that this move is made to appease Connor McDavid. I think this move is made to, having Connor McDavid there helps Chris Knobloch. Having Chris Knobloch there will help Connor McDavid. They know each other, but it's been a long time, almost a decade since they were together, right? So it's a little bit different. They've changed. Personalities change. It's not exactly the same. Does it help that they have a prior relationship? Yes. I don't believe that the Edmonton Oilers went out and hired Chris Knobloch because he was Connor McDavid's junior coach and because of the fact that they have a prior relationship and they're trying to appease Connor McDavid. They hired Chris Knobloch because they think he could be the guy that helped turn this thing around. And Connor has got to be part of that. And if he's your leader and he has a prior relationship with the coach, that will help. That will help the captain of the team bring the message of the coach into the room because he's new to everybody, really, except Connor McDavid, right? And Connor Brown. So,
And
Warren Fogle. There's familiarity is good, but this isn't to appease Connor McDavid.
Who cares if it is? Who cares? He's the superstar on the team. You want to alienate him? Go appease him. Hire all his friends. Make the assistant coaches his friends. Make the trainer his friends. Make the PR guy his friends. He is your franchise. He should be as happy as humanly possible. To sit here and say, I need to defend Connor McDavid because they're appeasing him, or there's a suggestion that this is an appeasement move to make the captain happy. Good.
But this isn't a move that the captain made. He didn't go
to management. Nobody said it was.
Right, but I think there's a narrative out there that can lend it to turning in that direction, and it shouldn't be. If there is, there shouldn't be. They hired a guy who's familiar with the coach, they're familiar with the best player. There isn't maybe a level of appeasement there, but that's not why they did it. They did it because they believe this guy can be a good coach, and he's been a successful coach. I mean, look, he was a successful coach in Hartford. He's paid his dues. He's getting an opportunity. He was a successful coach in junior hockey. He paid his dues at the NHL as an assistant. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out, but familiarity with players certainly helps. It helps Knobloch more than it probably helps McDavid.
Yeah. I don't have an issue with it at all, and the appeasement narrative kind of makes me sick. Like, you should appease your best players. Well, you want to alienate them? I'm going to go hire this guy that my best player hates because it'll wake up the room and you know, we were at the Hall of Fame, right? And Ken Hitchcock talked about it. He went into the Hall of Fame. We had him on the podcast last week. He apologized during his Hall of Fame speech to the players that he coached, because he was abrasive and he was antagonistic. And he believed that if you upset the players, they would bond together against the coach. And that was okay. And it would, these uncomfortable situations would push the players to where they needed to be winners, to be the best that they could be. And he believed it with all his heart. And then he was done and he saw the legacy. And he said he wanted a do-over during his speech. And he said, I want to thank all the players. I have the utmost respect for them. You know, they're the ones who did what they did. And it was an honor to be around them and all those things. So this antagonistic thing where there's this butting of heads, I don't think it works. So your best player, make them as happy as humanly possible. You work better when you're happy, Dan.
I do, Sean. I do.
Yeah. So we try and keep
you
happy. You
appease me sometimes.
We do. I appease you all the time. I appease you this whole weekend at Hockey Hall of Fame. Made you happy. You worked harder.
I did. I'm just happy that I brought it up because it got you all fired up, which is great. I love it. It's good. You should be fired up like that. All right. Listen.
Dude, I've had almost as many Red Bulls as the in-house announcer from the Toronto Maple Leafs, which you missed because you didn't go to the game.
I did hear him before the first period. I was there. I went through the anthem, and then my family showed up. Anyway, regardless, we're going to have Kevin Woodley on shortly here. Let's get to a few other things before we get to Kevin Woodley, who is our correspondent covering the Vancouver Canucks, also does a lot of In-Goal magazine. If you want goalie stuff, you go to Kevin Woodley. He does our Unmasked column. Just a terrific, terrific stuff job that he does with the goaltending and the Canucks. We'll talk all Canucks with him. All right, Sean, three teams I'm going to give you here. We were probably all wondering about them at the start of the season. Maybe we are still wondering about them now, but they're playing well. St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Washington. They're all playing well right now as we talk here on Thursday. Are they all for real? Are none of them for real? Who's for real among these three teams right now?
I don't know if any of them are for real, right? I see issues with all of them still, and I wonder about it. Like, and we could ask Kevin about this. Like, to me, the St. Louis Blues are as good as Binnington is.
Yeah.
And how good is he? He's been really good. But again, we rode the ride. We have the t-shirt. Like, he's been really good, and then he's been really bad. And he's lost the plot. And what is this? Like, where is he in his development? How many times have I sat on this podcast and said, oh, here's the Binnington that we all believe in, the one from the Stanley Cup final, the mystery, the wild ride, you know, this is the guy who caught lightning in a bottle. And then 2 weeks later, it's just gone off the rails.
Yeah. So I don't believe the Blues are for real. Okay. I'll say that right out. Their power play is abysmal. They're 0 for 18 at home on the power play. 0 for 18 at home on the power play. Their PK is not very good. They give up a lot more shots than they get. Binnington's been hot, and that's great. They don't have a go-to scorer. They only have two guys right now who are in double digits in points as we talk right now. That's Robert Thomas with 16 and Braden Schenn with 10. I think they've gotten on a little hot streak here as we talk here and have won three in a row. They got the San Jose Sharks tonight, Thursday night. So they've hit a nice bump. But I don't think that this is a team. The only thing that's going to help them, I think, really, is if they even – I think they're going to be inconsistently okay all year. The division might help them, right? Somebody else other than Dallas and Colorado have to make the playoffs in that division. And that could be St. Louis. We'll see. Could be Winnipeg. Could be Arizona. Could be any of these teams, right? The Capitals are another team that I question, all right? They're not scoring a lot. You know, their power play hasn't been good. Could it get good? Well, yeah, of course it can. Alex Ovechkin can get red hot. He's only got four goals right now. He scored two the other night. Their defense has been strong, but how long are they going to be able to keep that style of play up to where they just shut you down? And I question that, especially with their goaltending. So I have a question there. I do think the Pittsburgh Penguins are for real. I think their power play hasn't been very good yet. It will be. Their penalty kill has been solid. They generate a lot of shots on goal. They have star power. They're led by winners in, you know, Crosby and Malkin, and, you know, it go down the list. Erik Karlsson looks comfortable now. He didn't earlier in the season. I think that the Pittsburgh Penguins, I picked them to make the playoffs. I think they're for real. The Blues, I don't. The Caps, I question.
Yeah, look. There's no bigger Penguin supporter than me. I've advocated for them. I advocated for them last year when they lost, when they didn't make the playoffs. Like, I can't give up on that core, right? Crosby hat trick when they need him, point per game, fountain of youth. Malkin's playing the best he's played in years, right, at 37 or whatever he is. The interesting thing to me has been the Letang, who's approaching 700 games. I think it's tonight. He reaches his 700 game, and Karlsson, right? Early in the season, Karlsson was getting more playing time than Letang. Letang had become a clear number two. He was on the second power play, if he was on the power play at all. He's doing a ton of penalty killing, which he's never done before. But now Letang's ice time's starting to creep back up, and Karlsson's coming down. They're almost head-to-head now. And I think it's just a comfort level. I think it's like, you know, when you get a new thing in your car, right? You buy a new car and it's got like these new features. You don't figure out how to use them on the first road trip. Like, you're like, oh, I can't think about that. I just got to get in the car and go. And then, you know, by the second month, you're like, this is the greatest thing I've ever had. I can never go back to my old car because it's got this, this, and this. Like, to me, that's Mike Sullivan trying to figure out all of his add-ons, right? Mm-hmm. And now he's started to figure it out. They're getting a little more healthy. And they're good to go. I still have some questions about their depth in their four lines. Like, you know, when you get down to three and four, what happens? And when it's against a good team, that's a problem.
Yeah, by the way, you edit my copy, my writing all the time. I'm going to edit you here. Chris Letang's one away from his 700th point. He's played well over 1,000 games. So we'll just switch that around. But I know what you meant, all right? And Chris Letang didn't re-sign, and Evgeny Malkin didn't re-sign to, like, just maintain their star power and get their numbers and get their minutes, right? I mean, Letang didn't re-sign with the Penguins to forever be the number one defenseman who plays first power play and gets most minutes. He re-signed to win another Stanley Cup. That's why they did it. They believe that they can still do it. And you bring in Erik Karlsson, it's more on Karlsson to figure everything out here and Mike Sullivan to figure out what works. That's happened. I mean, Erik Karlsson has been on fire. He has been absolutely on fire. He's got points in six straight games. He's got 11 points in the past six games that he's got points in. So he's producing. Crosby's producing. They're getting the production from the guys they need to get it from. They're the leaders. They drive it. And I think the question that I have with Pittsburgh is still in goal. Like, I mean, can Tristan Jarry still be the guy? Can you ride him? Can you count on him, right? I think they can. If he stays healthy, he's a good goalie, Sean. He's just gotten injured at the wrong times in his career. Just really bad timing for his injuries. But if he stays healthy, this is a quality goaltender. The Penguins, I look at and I think to myself, they are for real. What's interesting is the two teams of the three that we're talking about here, St. Louis, Washington, and Pittsburgh, the two I think are better off are Pittsburgh and Washington, and they're in a much tougher division. like a much, much more deep division. So they're going to have to take somebody out, right? I mean, looking like the New York Islanders could be playing their way out of contention already, right? The New Jersey Devils, I think, are going to be fine, but they got to figure this thing out, and they don't have Hughes and Hischier right now. They're in a much tougher division than the Blues. The Blues might finish third in the Central by default because the other teams are just middling as well, whereas the Capitals and Penguins are going to have to play really good hockey in order to finish in the top four of that division and at least, you know, guarantee, not come close to guaranteeing a playoff spot, because on the other side, you got good teams too in the Atlantic. It's much harder right now in the Eastern Conference than it is in the Western Conference.
Yeah, I think that's true. And look, when you talk about the Penguins and you talk about Jarry, right? Like, yeah, he's gotten hurt at bad times, but at what point does that become commonplace, right? At what point that does he have the durability to make it through the season? And they don't have that second guy anymore, right? They don't have that guy that you kind of look down the bench and you're like, okay, here's my 1B. Like, there's a clear drop off now. So, like, Mike Sullivan has to decide, how hard do I ride this guy? How do I keep him healthy? How do I keep him durable? Like, is there an injury waiting around the corner? And if there is, there's huge trouble, right? It's kind of like Edmonton, right? They have all those guys and you're like, well, they got a lot of guys and they could do a lot of things, but if their goaltending's no good, I think the difference is Pittsburgh plays a little bit of more of a defensive game, even with those two big offensive threats going forward on their blue line. Part of being a really good defense is having the puck all the time, right? And that's kind of what Pittsburgh does. So I have questions about Jarry, but anytime we have questions about goalies, who better to have on the show than Kevin Woodley, who does Unmasked for us, writes for In Goal magazine, covers the Vancouver Canucks for us, and every time I speak to him about either Canucks or goaltending, I walk away smarter. So now you will too.
I'm smarter. The listeners will be smarter. You're smarter. Here's our interview with Kevin Woodley. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. So I'm going to start you out with the hardest question you'll get. Are the Vancouver Canucks the best team in the NHL?
Oh, are we? Wow. Are we at that
level? Yeah, we're talking that level now.
The Vancouver Canucks are a heck of a story. It is fun to be around them again. And listen, hey, I cover hockey for a living. That's always fun. But you guys know, if you've been around a team that's lost as badly and for as long as they have, it can get a little tough to be around some of those locker rooms. And it was that way here. And so to go from where they were to where they are now is remarkable. They're certainly playing like one of the top teams in the NHL. I think before we want to make statements like that, geez, this feels like I'm being negative Vancouver media, but I kind of want to see them against Vegas. I kind of want to see them against the Kings, right? Like, they beat the Oilers three times, and at the start of the season, we thought that was a really big deal. But right now, that may be in part a reflection of the Oilers.
Is there almost a sense, and maybe with the team a little bit too, like, are the wheels going to fall off? They have so many times, right? Like, they've changed coaches. We just talked about Edmonton getting a bump from changing their coach when in the first two games. Every coach that's come through Vancouver in the last little while, there's been a bump, and you've looked at him and you said, here's the voice. Here's the voice that's going to make them all better. It happened with Tok last year when he came in. It you know, it's happened with the coaches before that. With Bruce, it happened. Is there a little bit of a sense of, you know, you just said wait and see until they play better teams, but is there almost a little bit of a wait and see, let's see 40 games?
That may be from the outside and certainly from us in the media. And like I said, they're clearly, we knew coming in they'd be better. The personnel changes on the back end, the commitment that they seem to have under Tocchet's system. Like, that's the one thing we've seen, you're right, these bumps before, but the Boudreau bump, you know, by most metrics was unsustainable because it relied so heavily on goaltending and elite goaltending. And the difference is, and when Tocchet came in, he got them to buy in defensively in terms of how they play away from the puck, the way forwards backtrack, which was not always a strength of this team. And I think there were some underlying numbers there that said this was more sustainable. To this level, nobody was calling this. But I think there's less of that this time than there is in years past because of that improved, you know, they use the word structure a lot around here, but it's so much better than it was in the past. And so internally, when players, they know that this conversation is out there, they know there is a wait and see They know there are doubters, and I think they're using that still as fire and fuel. They're kind of buying into that, you know, let's show them all mentality. And you know, again, it's early and the opponents haven't always been at the top of the table, so to speak, but you know, it looks really, really promising at this point.
You know, it's interesting because I think this goes back to last season, obviously, when Taka took over, but more to the point when Demko came back. The schedule was soft and they didn't have anything to play for, but they just looked better. And I wonder, Kevin, if it's that instilling that structure that Taka was able to do before Demko came back that has enabled them to stick with that with the elite goaltending that they're also getting. It's not so much relying on Demko all the time, but it's understanding that guy's there when we need him. You know, like, I think of it in a way of like the Tampa Bay Lightning when Vasilevsky's in, right? I mean, you look at the Tampa Bay Lightning right now, and they're kind of all over the place because Vasilevsky's not in. It's Johansson, right? Look at the Canucks now. They're structured. They're good. And they know if there's a breakdown, they've got Demko. Is that part of it, that learning how to do this before they got their guy back?
Well, I mean, I think learning how to do it is a key to winning in today's NHL regardless. Like, even when Vasilevsky was there, the underlying numbers that I talked about, and obviously I have the privilege of getting to look under the hood at Clearsight Analytics from Steven Valiquette, 5-on-5 high danger chances against is quite often a, you know, one of the more predictive measures we have. Tampa Bay was elite in that category in the years they won the cup, and they had Vasilevsky back there. That was the number that got better under Tocchet. That's the number that I think there were question marks. Could they sustain it? Would the group stay committed to playing this way? And Ian Cole, one of the additions on the defense, gave me a great quote the other day. It's riddled with expletives, so I won't share it. But just about the importance of backtracking forwards, right? And so what that does for your ability to stand up at the blue line, what that does to force a dump in rather than an odd man rush, and how that allows you to transition back to offense. And, you know, a lot of the things he talked about in terms of structure, frankly, weren't here for the past number of years. And some of that, like, I don't think that's necessarily on coaches. Like, there are things that this young team needed to learn how to do. The leadership group, which has matured, Quinn Hughes, Elias Pettersson, you know, even Brock Besser, JT Miller, who's you know, obviously 30, but, you know, he talked about it last year. A lot of these young players came onto a team that wasn't expected to win. They got opportunities at the top of the lineup early in their careers. And all they had to do to sort of have perceived success was play well offensively, and there wasn't a lot of stress on these defensive habits. And so it's only now that they're sort of starting to understand that's what it takes to win. And I think you saw, like, Tampa Bay had that as much as they had Vasilevsky. Now you add in Demko back to his old self and playing at an elite level, and at a level that, you know, right now is pretty much unmatched in the league in terms of his numbers relative to expected save percentage and expected goals. And yeah, like, that's a really good formula. Like, they're on a heater, shooting percentage and goaltending. Is some of that going to level off? Absolutely. The question is, when it does, will it be a team that can still win 3-2 or 2-1, as opposed to right now where a lot of these games are 5-2 or 6-2 because they pull away from teams? And I think because of that structure, the answer is more likely yes. And to go back to Edmonton, like, again, I know people are all over the goaltending at Edmonton. I'm not going to sit here and blow smoke and tell you it's been fantastic. But this is where the Canucks were at the start of last year. And even before the Demko injury, look at his numbers. Like, his numbers fell off a cliff. If you are a bottom 3-4-5 team defensively in the NHL and the Oilers give up more of the most dangerous chances off the rush than anyone in the National Hockey League right now, if you are that team, goaltending doesn't really matter. You can have a Demko, and there's only so much they can do. When you get that buy-in defensively, and it's not just about having a good defense or an improved defense, it's about buy-in from all five guys, now that goaltender has a chance to be great.
And I think you're seeing that a little with the Devils now, right? With some of their injuries and the blaming of the goaltenders there. Like, they're not playing a very good defense. But for me, with Vancouver, I saw them Hall of Fame weekend, and they did not look very good against Toronto. But it's, you know,
it figures.
Yeah, and it's hockey night in Canada. Like, that's the one game you don't want to have a stinker. And after the game, they were all really upset, right? They were like, geez, like, this was our chance to show people. But they were coming from Ottawa. You know, there was a lot of hoopla around the game, and they didn't play very well. And Toronto played really well, better than they've played in a long time. But they came out of it, right? And they win that game against the Islanders. They're down 3-1. All of a sudden, you're looking at that game, and you're like, uh-oh, here it is. But they have this unbelievable confidence that they can score when they need to. And that makes all of this a little better. Like, again, you look back to the, I think it was the last Edmonton game. What was it? The shots, 18-1 in the first period. And they were winning three. They ended up being ahead 3-1 because Demko stood on his head. And then the Edmonton goalie gave up a really bad goal. And all Vancouver was to the races. Like, that's a really healthy combination.
Yeah, and to just go back to some of the underlyings on that, and this surprised even me. I covered that game. I praised Demko as loudly as anyone in my post-game coverage. The next morning, I looked at the numbers, and out of those 18, I think it was actually 19 shots the Oilers had in the first period, only two were high danger. So again, even when they're sort of bleeding possession, they're limiting quality. Not all the time, but more than they have in the past. You know, you hear Tocchet talk a lot about his goaltenders only having to solve one half of the ice. And we know, you know, from the numbers that anything, well, we know it instinctively as goaltenders. Anytime a play goes across the middle of the ice and forces you to completely change your angle 180 degrees from, you know, a pass goes through the middle, through the slot line from, say, the left faceoff dot to the right faceoff dot, the amount of work I have to do to sort of get rotation and square up on that next shot, like, it's a lot. And so if you can create plays like that, you're going to score more goals. And the Canucks used to bleed plays like that defensively, especially on the PK. There's still been a fair amount, but nothing like there was in the past. So the goalies can, and you're watching, Demko's more aggressive. Like, he's actually getting to the edge of his crease rather than playing two-thirds depth because he trusts that the guys in front of him, even if one gets through on a lateral, it's not going to be followed up by another one the other way. And that wasn't the case for the last number of years.
So I want to ask you about Quinn Hughes, because it also goes back to that defending and that structure and being able to play that way. We've for years looked at Quinn Hughes as a guy who's an offensive guy and he can generate. And I mean, just look, the goal he scored last night, right? I mean, just jumping up, the great play, good vision by JT Miller. You know, that's a it's overtime, but like, that's a terrific play offensively. But he obviously a couple of weeks ago came to his own defense, right? And basically was just like, no. I'm a defenseman. Like, this is, I play defense. Okay. This is my way. I have been a good defenseman. You don't got to put a stay at home guy next to me. No. Like, I'm the guy who can do that. And he's kind of proving that this season, right? Is this just the growth of Quinn Hughes, or has he been this player, but because of the flash, because he makes like 45 spinoramas a game, like, you know what I mean? That we just haven't noticed it.
Yeah, I think, honestly, he would tell you that. And I think his argument is fair, especially last year, right? Like, there was a couple of years ago where, for sure, the defensive game was in a spotlight that he didn't like, and it was deservedly so. But last year, I don't have the numbers in front of me. You guys may know, but just off the top of my head, I can't, like, on a team that was brutal in goal differential at 5-on-5, you know, I think he was plus 16.
He was a big plus.
Yeah. And you know, so I think in his mind, he showed last year, and playing with a wide variety of games of defensive partners, none of whom I would, you know, call a household name. And, you know, he produced results like that. And so I think he's right when he pushes back on the narrative that he's never been a defensive defenseman. I think that part of his game took a lot of strides. And now this year, what you're actually seeing is he's added a shot. He worked all summer on sort of, and we saw that shot last night in overtime. He's not just shooting it harder. He's hiding releases. He's using screens better. That's another area the Canucks have been a lot better. When I look at, you know, some of the metrics I've access to, like, they're a bottom 10 team in terms of setting screens and getting shots through traffic on the net. And now they're, you know, I haven't looked recently, but they were top 10 last time I looked. And guys like Besser, not just going to the net, and JT Miller, not just going to the net, but going to the net with strategy, where defensemen like Hughes are looking for certain times where they say, you know, we know goalies like to look short side around a screen. Well, if I'm a screener and my defenseman's just about to load up for a shot, I adjust my screen and try and either push him further to the short side so he's got further to travel the other way to make a save, or just as that release is coming, I push him so far that he figures he has to look around the screen the other way and give up his sight and not see the release. Like, there's a level of their shooting percentage right now that's obviously unsustainable. But there are also nuanced things that they're doing, led by a guy like Quinn Hughes and with complementary pieces like Miller and Besser in front of the net, that are part of why they're having so much success offensively. And to Sean's point earlier, like, the confidence is off the charts. The power play, with Rick Tocchet taking over, running the power play himself and making that decision, it's so dynamic. Like, it's rarely static. It's always moving around. And there are so many different weapons. I mean, Philip Hronek, let go of a shot last night on the 5-on-3 that I think originally the Canucks tweeted out something about being measured at 107 miles an hour. I think the NHL Edge data came back and said it was just over 100. But regardless, top of the circle with JT Miller in front, very little chance for Ilya Sorokin to tie that game on the 5-on-3. Philip Hronek's got an 11-game point streak now. He's not even on their top power play unit. Like, they have a lot of weapons right now offensively, and it matters for a change because they're all doing the work to take care of their own end first.
Let me ask you this, though. Did Pettersson just say, that's it, I've had enough? Like, he's a guy that's so driven, right? Like, I remember seeing him, I think it was his rookie year, he was playing in Buffalo, and they were playing Darlene, and there was a big story, and they lost. And he was just bitter. He was just sour. Like, I don't want to talk about this. We lost. That's all I care about. Thank you. And he walked away. Like, and that's who he is. Like, that's how he's driven. And he went through a lot of bad stuff in Vancouver, a lot of losing that he didn't like. Like, for him, has it just gotten to the point where he just said, that's it, I'm going to be the difference?
Well, I mean, you look at, what, he's over 100 points last season, right? Like, I think a lot of this has been there. And I think you're right. Like, and they've said this. Quinn has said it. Thatcher Demko said it. Like, the leadership group, which is relatively young, plus JT Miller, is just kind of fed up with losing. And they recognize that they're the ones that have to set this standard. They're not 19, 20, and 21 anymore. They're 23, 24, 25, 27 for Demko. And they're sort of, I think they're all collectively sort of pulling on that rope, Sean. Like, it's, you know, and Pettersson, for sure. You know, like, JT Miller, like, listen, at this point last season, there were serious questions, and it was being asked openly in this market about whether JT Miller could even be a center in the National Hockey League. Like, he's a better winger. Can he do the defensive things required to play center? Now, on a line that's got Brock Besser, another guy we used to think of as just a shooter, they're the shutdown matchup. They're, you know, like, I don't know that Miller's getting mentioned in the Selke, but maybe he should at some point. Like, he is the guy that's hard matching McDavid and shutting him down for three games. He's the guy that's getting on. So I don't know that it's just Pettersson that's taken on that attitude, Sean. Like, certainly you see it from him. I just think, like I said at the top of this, right? Like, it hasn't been fun around here. And with Tocchet sort of showing them how to get there, they've all bought in. And as a leadership group, as young as it is, they're going to be the ones that are setting that example in terms of those little habits, backtracking through the neutral zone, not giving too much defensively. And you've heard the comments, like, they take accountability. They go into the coach, Pettersson going into the coach's office, I think maybe after that Toronto game, and saying, like, I had a bad game. Like, the coach has had to be all over them at times early, but I think now it's become something they've taken ownership of in terms of when they don't play well. And there's been moments, right? The start of that Islanders game, they're down 2-0. And yeah, you have the confidence and a little bit of swagger. Quinn Hughes said afterwards, I always believed we were going to come back and win that game. But there's also accountability with that when they aren't at their best. Human nature says there's going to be some downtime here. They're going to, I can say, get fat and happy. But this is a team that in their younger years got fat and happy quite easily. And that's why you saw strong finishes that it meant nothing the next season. I think they're just sick of being that group.
Yeah. Well, by the way, I turned that game on with about 4 minutes to go in the first period against the Islanders, and I was like, they're not losing this game. Just the way they were playing and the way they are playing. I wanted to get to it. Sean and I were talking before we had you on about the Blues and Jordan Binnington in particular, and his numbers look terrific right now. He's been good. They're playing better. But they're a team, and I was saying this to Sean, and I was saying, like, I don't think they're for real. And I don't know if he is for real, if this is what it is for Binnington this season, if he's going to be this goalie, or is this just a good streak? Is there anything you can see from what any time you've watched Binnington this season, or, you know, talk to people who might know what, you know, his, you know, his game well, that is this sustainable for Jordan Binnington? Because, I mean, the numbers and the play has been quite inconsistent, especially, you know, since they won the Stanley Cup, really.
Yeah, no, like, so a couple things here. One, like, he's one of the few guys that's up there with Demko in terms of just having this incredible adjusted save percentage early in the year. Like, they're the top guys right now, or two of the three top guys. But they're at a level that, you know, it's pretty tough to sustain. Like, when Vezina, I think they're both around, last I checked yesterday, it was like plus 6.5% above expected save percentage. You win a Vezina trophy if you can get through a year at like +2.5 or +3, right? So asking them to play at this level over an 82-game season, even with starts being reduced in today's NHL, it's probably just not realistic. So to expect it to continue at this level, that's a big ask for any goalie historically. That said, I think the other part of this is, like, the Blues won a cup and a lot of people talked about how great defensively they are. And since then, it's been purely narrative. They have leaned heavily on goaltending. They have not been a great defensive team. Their goalies have typically come in at the end of the year with some of the lowest expected save percentages around the league. They lean heavily on Binnington. And he has in the past had stretches. I remember, when there was talk about needing and, who's going to be Canada's goalie when the Olympics were still an option. Like, Binnington was one of the guys I pointed to because his adjusted numbers were always so good. And a lot of people looked at the raw numbers and were like, No, I don't see it. I'm like, no, because they're not good defensively. They lean on him heavily and he answers the bell more nights than he doesn't. But sustaining it has been a challenge for him. And I would argue when things are that loose, we saw it here in Vancouver, Demko at the beginning of last season, it's really hard to maintain that level. It's harder because the trusting things around you becomes difficult, right? Like, it's the old sort of 10 years ago Oilers thing when they were, just like chewing up and spitting out goaltenders. Like, and we can all see the defense. If your defenseman's supposed to get that backdoor pass and that's his job and you're trusting him to do his job, and the first nine times he doesn't do it and somebody taps it into the net and you're sitting on the shooter and you're not cheating because that's not my job, he's got it and he just doesn't and he doesn't and he doesn't, you're eventually going to start to lean. And in this league, as soon as you cheat, as soon as you're lean, you're done. And so it's a simplistic example of the importance of trust between goaltender and system and defenseman and forwards too, and the personnel and being where they're supposed to be. And in a tough defensive environment, I believe a tough defensive environment can become cumulative for goaltenders. It's just harder and harder to maintain that level and that trust when things break down as regularly as they do. The game is so unpredictable as goaltenders. We all crave a predictable environment, and that just doesn't exist in the NHL anymore. But some are more predictable than others. And it's not a coincidence that the most predictable tend to be the most goalie-friendly. And I point to the Los Angeles Kings, for example, the past number of years. I'm not going to say it doesn't matter who's in net, but you've seen multiple different goaltenders have success there because there's a predictability in how they play in front of them that allows them to make reads, limit options, and focus on one or two things, not five or six.
Kevin, last one for me. Am I a bad person? Because I don't think that Jarry can stay healthy in Pittsburgh, and I have questions about whether Demko can stay healthy in Vancouver. Like, there's these narratives around goalies, right? That some of them can't stay healthy, and it's because they haven't. But to believe that, is that justifiable?
Listen, it's like a guy who breaks in as a number one goaltender has a great first year, right? Until you do it, you haven't done it. And, so to reach that upper echelon of number one goaltender is like, 1 year's great, but can you repeat it? Because consistency is one of the tougher things, right? Like, we've seen UC Saros being elite for multiple years now in a row. Other guys, there'll be a little bit of ups and downs. We know they're great. Igor Shesterkin after winning the Vezina. Like, until you've done it, you haven't done it. And so staying healthy counts. Like, that's part of that equation, right? Thatcher Demko had a number of injuries, didn't make it through the year two seasons ago, in part because the workload and what they were asking him to do on a nightly basis in terms of extending and making dramatic saves that opened up and pulled his body apart behind a defense that gave up all those East-West chances. And that carried over into last season in terms of, breaking down early and ending up missing a bunch of time. And so until you get through a season healthy and show that you can stay healthy, even through a playoff run, those questions are fair, Sean. Because until you've done it, you haven't done it. In Demko's case, and I don't know Tristan specifically, but in Thatcher's case, he changed some things when he was hurt last year. He was introduced to a trainer whose name people who read Unmasked on NHL.com have probably heard over the years me mention. He's based up in Kelowna here. His name's Adam Francilia. He works with, I think he's got close to 12 or 13 NHL clients right now, the most prominent being Connor Hellebuck. Like, they started working together, I think, within a year of Hellebuck sort of establishing himself as the number one and winning the Vezina. And so Thatcher's got a different approach that started while he was hurt. And that's what I've always loved. And it's not just Thatcher. I love goalies that leave no stone unturned, that are always looking for ways to get better. And so rather than pout about the injury and having his season taken away from him so early after such a promising year the season before, Thatcher found somebody to help. and he's changed the way he trains, changed the way he works. I think he feels better about his body. There's a confidence there. And again, proof will be in the pudding. Does he get through an entire season healthy? It's still a dynamic, unpredictable game and tougher on goalies than ever before. But I like the work he's put in and the fact it's different. He's training to be a goalie, not training to be a hockey player. And there's some specific things within that that I think at the very least, Sean, increase his odds of getting through this season healthy and having a long career, something that I think, you know, after the early season injury last year, there were people that wondered if that would be the case.
Well, Kevin, before you jumped on, we were talking about how every time we have you on, we learn something and the audience learns something. The listeners always do. They definitely did this time. So thanks for bringing it. You leave no stone unturned. Thanks for joining us, man.
It's my pleasure, guys. Anytime.
I wasn't kidding, Sean. You said it before we brought him on. You always learn something from Kevin Woodley. We definitely learned something in that interview. He's terrific. We should have our own like Kevin Woodley spot on every episode, except it would go for 25 minutes and that would take up a lot of time. So we can't do it.
You can just replace me with him.
Well, I don't want to jump at that opportunity.
Look at how excited you got.
I did jump for a second there. I did. I'll admit it. I jumped. But no, you're irreplaceable, Sean. Irreplaceable.
Yeah, nobody's irreplaceable.
Anyway, so the Global Series is going on right now. Literally right now. As we talk, I have it on in front of me. Detroit and Ottawa playing now. 4 games, 4 days. You got Detroit, Ottawa, Toronto, Minnesota. A bunch of guys going home. William Nylander's a big story there. There's no question about it. Bill Price and Mike Zeisberger are there for us at NHL.com. You've covered this. I've covered this. It's always interesting to see the reaction of NHL hockey in that market, in Stockholm. I've seen it in Prague. I've seen it in Stockholm. I've seen it in Helsinki. Regular season games being played in those markets. It's a huge hockey markets. Huge hockey markets. And they know their NHL. I mean, just listen to Henrik Lundqvist in the, you know, this past weekend, right, at Hall of Fame weekend, how he used to, you know, catch all the highlights. You weren't getting all the games. And now they get all the games. But, oh, they're on at 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning. Now they're on right there, 8 o'clock at night in Stockholm. One day, I think it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon that's going to be. So it's 2 o'clock here, 2 p.m. Eastern or 8 a.m. Eastern. But it's always it's a great event, I think, and it really brings to life how big this game is and how big this league is in particular, is what I should say, on the international scale.
And for the people in North America, you get to watch hockey while you're supposed to be working. So for the
like
next 4 days.
Right now.
Exactly. So that's great. But no, it is great. Like, William Nylander is going home, and it's the first time a lot of his friends will ever see him play. His grandma's going to see him play for the first time. I think he said something like he had to buy 90 tickets free to the two games that the Maple Leafs are playing. That's a lot of cash, dude. His next contract better be a good one, and he's playing his way into it, right? Wow. But, you know, like, Alfredson's on the bench today for Ottawa. It's his first time on the bench since he rejoined the team. Like, there's always great stories here. You know, the Swedes love to show off their culture. You know, Bill and Zeiss have done some fun things with culture, with studios that's going to be appearing on our site in the next couple of days. At one point, a couple of players made Swedish meatballs, and we had Johan Haig, who's a very famous musician there, judge who made the best meatballs. So it's a lot of fun stuff going on, plus a lot of meaningful games. There's some teams there that really need some wins, right? In Minnesota and in Ottawa, you know, Detroit wants to keep up. Toronto has been middling. Like, they could use a couple of wins in a row to feel good for them about themselves. So there's a lot on the line in these games. So it's always a great time. And you know, the crowds are fantastic.
Well, listen, I mean, a couple of years ago, the Tampa Bay Lightning went. I think you were there with them at the time. They put Stockholm in their championship rings because they believe it changed their season when they went there in the 2019-20 season. Yes, it was interrupted by COVID and whatnot, but that trip to Stockholm for the Global Series changed their season. That's what they believe. They even have it in their rings. Derek Lalonde talked about that. So it's a great time. Hockey on midday. Can't complain about it. Let's go a couple other things. So we were in Toronto, Sean, and in addition to Hall of Fame weekend, it was also the general managers meeting on Tuesday. And probably the most interesting thing to come out of that meeting was the conversation. And I want to make sure we stress just the conversation. Nothing is happening now. They're just discussing things about a change in overtime. And it's essentially to stop the regroup, if you will, in overtime. So you carry the puck over the blue line. You don't like what you see. You pull it back out. And they're like, well, do we like that? Is it a good thing? Is it taking away from some of the excitement of 3-on-3 overtime? Can we guard against that? Can we rule against that? Can we make that illegal, the regroup? Just a conversation that they're having. And I'll be honest with you, Sean, I don't know how you do it. To continue to make 3-on-3 overtime exciting with less stoppages, how are you going to then do that? Because it's a play in the game now. When they pull it out, it's not a delay tactic. It's a pull out in order to attack with speed again, but just a different route, if you will, or whatever. I don't have a problem with it. I still think 3-on-3 is exciting as can be. I honestly think that if you make that change, you're going to see guys double team guys, trap guys in the corner at the point, try to create a turnover. You're going to see a defenseman stay back. You're not going to see that Quinn Hughes goal that we saw Wednesday night where he's jumping up in the play and JT Miller, you know, finds him coming into the zone. He's going to probably stay back because he has to be a defenseman now instead of always pushing. I don't have a problem with it. The way it is right now, I understand the conversation is being had because they're always exploring ways that that might be able to make the game better. But in my estimation, the unintended consequences are too great on this one.
Yeah, look, I think it's great that they are always looking, right? They're always trying to identify things that could make the game better, make the game safer, whatever it is. And I think there's this allure when you think back to the beginning of 3-on-3. And you see it sometimes now when things just go haywire, right? That chaos of 3-on-3. Very early on, it was uncoachable. So it was just six guys getting on the ice and being, all right, let's go. Like, this is how I played on the pond. And this is it, right? Like, we're going to go, and then you're going to go, and we're going to go, and eventually somebody's going to score, or we're all going to get really tired. And then coaches get paid to coach. Players get paid to figure things out. Some very smart minds said, how can we gain an advantage? There's a long change involved. It's very hard for teams to change. If I get possession of the puck at the beginning of overtime, let me wear those three guys out. Chase me.
Mm-hmm.
Chase me all over the ice. And then when you get tired, I can even make a change because it's the short change if I'm in the attacking zone and I'm going to get you. But then there's only two or three chances in an overtime, right? Like either a penalty happens or there's a shot and the goalie's able to move it to his defenseman and they go the other way. So there's been a coaching element that's taken away that chaos. But that's always going to happen.
The thing about it now is overtime, and listen, they talked about this at the GM meetings, that it's a very much a possession game overtime. And you win the faceoff, you maintain possession. You do not want to ever give it up because if you give it up, oftentimes if you give it up, it's an odd man rush the other way, right? If you make the change to where they can't attack, if you make the change to where they can't regroup, once you gain the zone, you have to stay there, essentially. You can't pull it out with possession. I think you're going to see a lot of dump-ins, a lot of chasing the puck around. I don't know if it'll increase the offense. In fact, I think what it'll do is increase the defense and take less risk. It'll create less risk in the game in overtime. Right now, once you have possession, you're looking for that opening. Right, you're looking for that opening, and how do I attack with speed to get that opening and beat a team that way? And if you give it up, it's typically an odd man rush the other way. Right now, if you change it, they're going to be less looking for that opening, more looking to just get the puck in and try to grind again. It's going to be less skill, and those turnovers are not going to be leading to odd man rushes. They're just going to be leading simply to changes in possession because you're going to have a guy hanging back a little bit further to avoid the odd man rush. Now you have the defenseman stepping up to create the third man in attack. I don't think that'll happen. I think that's how they'll coach offense out of overtime, I think, if they make this change.
That's what coaches do. They try and take offensive leg because it's unpredictable. Defense is predictable. That's the control. Yep. Offense is chaos, right? So, look, just play pond hockey at that point. No rules. No lines, no nothing. Just go ahead and play. But I think the hard thing is if you're on a team or you're a fan of a team and overtime happens and you never touch the puck and the other team scores. It's like the old football rule, right? Well, whoever gets possession and they score, the game's over. Well, I never got to touch the football. I think a lot of it's the same thing in hockey. The Devils won the opening faceoff and they held on to the puck for 3.5 minutes and Jack Hughes scored. My team never touched the puck. How is that fair?
Win the faceoff then. Win the faceoff then. That's my argument to that.
It was a great time in Toronto. The meetings. The other thing we need to mention really quickly, a lot of player safety stuff going on. Neck guards, wrist guards, a lot of discussion about that. You're going to see a lot more of it as we go forward. There'll be more discussion about not it becoming mandatory, but as they push it, it's being pushed really hard in the lower leagues, the AHL and the ECHL. So, and there's more equipment available. That was the big thing that came out of the meeting on Tuesday, is the fact that there is equipment to meet every player's needs, where that might not have been the case 6 months ago.
Yeah, they just got to get the companies on board and the players on board to be able to manufacture it at a higher level than it's probably manufactured now. And you get everybody on board, there'll be a demand, there'll be a supply, right? That's kind of how economics work. This was a lot of fun. We thank Kevin Woodley for jumping on with us. The Global Series is going on right now. There's a lot of hockey to come. We'll be back next week with a pre-Thanksgiving episode. Enjoy the hockey.